الْمُرْسَلِينَ
The people of Noah denied the messengers.
إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ
When their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear Allah?
Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we have reached the 106th verse of this chapter, Surah Al-Shu'ara. كَذَّبَتْ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ The people of Noah rejected the messengers when their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear? Now we explained the story of Prophet Abraham, and prior to that, the story of Prophet Moses, and how the Holy Quran ended up telling us that these are the stories you need to understand and through which you need to believe in the Lord of the worlds. And there is great sign in these stories. Now, the Holy Quran refers to this part of Noah's life, which is rather similar to what was formerly mentioned about the life of Moses and Abraham. So it says, إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ Remember the time when their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear? أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ Will you not fear Allah? Now, this is really interesting since the application of a brother, أَخُوهُمْ, in this verse, is a kind of sense which shows the ultimate affection relationship that is based upon equality. It means without intending to have any priority over them. Just like one of themselves, Prophet Noah invited them to piety. And this happened with utmost purity and sincerity. I mean, his behavior and his demeanor with and among the people was only based on this relationship with them. And he did not claim to be superior over them. He just tried to invite them as one of their brethren and brothers.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So the verse says, إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ When their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear Allah? This application of the word brother that we explained, the concept of brotherhood in this word not only has been used for Noah, but it also has been applied for many other prophets, such as Prophet Hud, Salih, and Lut. This inspires all the leaders of the path of the truth that they must observe the utmost love and sincerity in their call if they are to invite people to monotheism, when they are far from any self-superiority. This is the time that the annoyed hearts can be attracted by the religion. This is the time that no one feels heaviness. And this is the time that most of the people will kindly accept the invitation. And one of the other important things that can be understood from this word أخوه is that in order to be called one of the brothers of the people, you need to be in them, you need to live in them, you need to be aware of their own cultures, their language, their customs, their pros and cons, and all the aspects of their lives in order to be called a brother. That is why the invitation is based on this brotherhood. قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ. Only one can be called a brother to people who is aware of their thoughts, who is aware of their behaviors, their pros and cons, and whatever they are in need of. And the last point regarding this verse is that he called them to piety. أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Aren't you feared of the Almighty Allah? This means even if you are from the ones that are pious, even if you are from the ones that are truly believing in the monotheism, you do not need to stop. You have to start inviting others to monotheism and to piety as well. And this is one of your responsibilities, to try to guide the others. إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Today in our studio, we have with us Dr. Ali Alavi, who is an Islamic researcher and educationalist. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, we have been talking about self-confidence, especially in terms of children. Mm-hmm. And we talked about a few factors, what is self-confidence and what role it plays in Islamic upbringing. But then I, as a parent, am confused whether my child has a self-confidence or has he lost it. Mm-hmm. So what are the signs that help me as a mother or as a parent to check the level of the self-confidence in my child?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. As we said earlier, that self-confidence has a key role in the upbringing of the kids, and we have to, as parents, be careful and cautious on the level of confidence that our kids have or they are equipped with. I mean, there are some features, in case we actually pay attention to them, we understand that our kid has at least, let's say, a normal level of self-confidence or not.
Okay.
So we give some signs that shows that our kids are actually are having their self-confidence or not.
Right.
One of the signs that we are going to talk about is the independent actions. I mean, independent action, or let's say, acting maturely. It doesn't mean that we should pave the way for the kid to do whatever he likes. No, even in the simple actions of their ordinary lives, find after one or two, three times of imitating from the elderly ones, they find their own way to do the action independently. Let me give you an example. Since this discussion of self-confidence, as I said in the previous session, is usually important on the kids of, let's say, those who just are about to start their second decade of life.
Yeah.
So it means that when we are talking about a kid of, let's say, 8, 9, or 10 years old, when we send him to school, we have to be expecting him at least sometimes to come back independently home.
Yeah.
You see? So this action, when we see that he is doing this action maturely, that is, he knows while coming back from school to home, he has to observe the, let's say, traffic lights and the rules of traffic.
The road safety.
The road safety.
Yeah.
So it means that this kid has reached to a level of confidence.
Carrying out his activities independently.
Definitely. And sometimes we see the next sign that I'm going to give to the respected listeners to know that if their kids have enough self-confidence or not is just to see that he, as the subject or the kid, is proud of his successes. That is, he has done something and he has proud of it. For example, the same example that we talked about, coming mm-hmm. back from school alone or independently.
All right.
While back home or talking to his friends or to his other, let's say, classmates, he's honored of, for example, going back home. And he's not going to boast and, let's say, to bluff about his abilities. But he says, oh, no, it's quite an easy thing and I have done it. And I just need to care about, let's say, the different signs that I see in the street or the traffic lights.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And we would love to know more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we're talking about self-confidence when it comes to upbringing. Well, Dr. Alavi, you said there are some signs that parents could see, and actually looking on those signs, they can understand where is the level of the self-confidence in their children. You talked about independent actions, and now after independent actions, you said that they will be proud of their successes.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So there is another sign that we can understand that our kid or a child is self-confident is that we see that he accepts the kind of failures that he had in his affairs.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and it's not the case for him to escape from a wrong action that he has done already. So when he's asked that, have you really passed or failed in this issue? He says, I mean, very frankly, no. I failed and I have to. I need more practice to do it again.
Yeah.
You see, a person or let's say a child who has,
Accepts
he doesn't have self-confidence usually tries to actually resort to some lies and say, okay, no, it was not me or it was not another person that has done it. He wants to in some way to escape from whatever has been done or whatever he has done already.
Yeah, whatever has happened.
The next sign that we can infer that our kid is benefited from self-confidence or not is that he tries to examine the new eras, the new arenas. Mm-hmm. That is, he is accepting the risk of entering different challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not going to be, in doubt in, let's say, entering in this topic, in this subject, or in this issue or not. So we have to be careful. We do not mean that he has to have this, let's say, unlimited courage to do anything, whatever he is facing. No.
Yeah.
We're talking about the normal issues or normal, examples
that
we have
physically
in our vicinity or in our area or in our environment.
Yeah.
So he accepts the challenge of entering those arenas and to show if he is going to be, successful or to fail it.
Yeah.
So he doesn't care for the result. He prefers to enter into a scene that is worthy of, that is actually being logically accepted by the people.
Mm-hmm.
So the next sign that we can actually give to the parents or let's say the guardians about the self-confidence of their kids is to see that he helps the people in the town that they are in need of him or her.
Mm-hmm.
So if we see that this child or kid is helping, by help, look, I think respected listeners should not be expecting that, I mean, let's say, I don't know, paying a huge amount of money or no, I'm going to have a quite transfer a big workload or something like that. No. Mm-hmm. To the extent that is about his own ability or her abilities.
As for the age.
As much as his age or her age actually gives her or him this chance to help the others.
Yeah.
So when we see that he finds this courage to go and enter in these fields, it means that this subject is self-confident.
Yeah. We'll talk more on that, Dr. Alavi, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet ﷺ said, honor your children.
and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we're talking about self-confidence, the signs that could tell us if a child has self-confidence or not. Dr. Alavi, I'll tell the list of the titles that you discussed so far, the signs. You said a child, if he carries out independent actions, he is self-confident, if he is proud of his successes, if he accepts the failures, if he has got the courage to examine new arenas and accepts the risk of entering new challenges, helps others in need, a child is definitely self-confident.
Definitely. So we have to be concerned in case we see in any of these areas of, let's say, self-confidence, our son or our child or our daughter actually has some shortages. We have to be very cautious. And it is because it affects his or her growth and at the same time and his her or his abilities in future. Yeah. So we have to be worried about that in case we find, for example, in one or two element or segments, he or she has some shortages. So we have to consult with those who know better, or let's say with psychologists and let's say counselors. So we have to be monitoring and observing these areas very carefully. We have given, I think, a sort of, let's say, criteria to the parents to know if their kids and children are self-confident or not.
So far, we discussed about the signs of self-confidence. What are the things that take the self-confidence down?
Look, when we are talking about the self-confidence, once again, I'd like to repeat it in this show again, that our subjects, or let's say, the target community that we are talking about are the kids of 7 years and above. I'm not talking about the infants or, let's say, preschoolers. You know why? As I said earlier, they automatically have this self-confidence by themselves, and we have to be careful again not to strengthen that in order to exceed its limits. Mm-hmm. I mean, while they are in ages lower than that.
Yeah.
And not to stand in front of it and, let's say, stop it, I mean, in the way that actually this self-confidence is ruined.
Yeah.
So I wanted to remind the respected listeners that the target community of our discussion is the children, or the, let's say, the kids of 7 years old and above. One of the factors that actually results in lack of self-confidence or weakening the self-confidence is feeling unworthy. What does it mean, feeling unworthy? Because, you know, it's quite a wrong conception to say or to think that our kids don't understand too much. No, they are highly brilliant, and they know, and they can understand and digest too many even complicated things.
All right.
So when we are talking to them, when we are actually acting in front of them, we have to be careful that they are not ordinary people. I mean, and they are not people with low understanding. Mm-hmm. No, they can understand too much things, but to the level of their age, even sometimes they even learn beyond their age level, but they cannot actually show the feedback. You see, they cannot show the feedback for us to know that he or she has understood whatever has happened in his or her area.
Yeah.
So look, I mean, these intelligent existences, these intelligent, let's say, people, can easily understand that through some actions that they have done already, there is a sort of, let's say, a feeling of being unworthy has been started to grow in the minds, even or the hearts of the people around them.
Yeah.
You see? For example, they think that they have done something in comparison to their friends, let's say, or whatever they have done in circles of the people of the same age with them, like the other kids, they understand whatever they have done is not as good as the others.
Yeah.
And they will analyze the feedback that they are receiving from the people around them.
Yeah.
That is, even the elderly ones. So let's talk about this, inshallah, in our upcoming session.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Ali Alavi, for being with us. Inshallah, we'll talk more on that in the next session. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Ukraine and Russia.
Part 2.
Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. One of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok,
leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitaly Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR.
Both EU and Ukrainian officials said on Thursday the suspension of talks on closer ties could be revived after the two-day meeting. But officials said the deal was off the table for now.
Pro-EU protests on the streets of Kiev enter their second day. The crowd of around 1,000 protesters were joined by the leader of the opposition, the reigning world boxing champion Vitaly Klitschko. He called on the demonstrators to maintain pressure on the government after it decided not to sign a major trade deal with the EU.
Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies that helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side presented more favorably. They work on things like, how do you get traction? How do you get things to go viral? How do you then use that to generate support for your cause?
And support was generated.
Mustafa
Nayem, a founder of one of Ukraine's new media outlets, Gromadske TV, knew very well how to make something go viral. It was his notorious Facebook post on November 21st, 2013, that brought the first crowds to Maidan. If you don't read the newspaper, you are uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you are misinformed. To deliver your message efficiently enough in the modern world with so many different technologies and means of communications, you must embrace them all. As the disturbing events of Euromaidan started on November 21st, 2013, three new TV channels went on the air and suddenly became stunningly popular in Ukraine. Spilno TV, November 21st. Romatske TV, November 22nd. And Espresso TV, November 24th, directly from opposition protest. These channels went viral, supporting the protests and encouraging more and more people to come to Maidan. November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events.
After riot police attacked peaceful protesters with clubs.
It happened in the early morning hours. The eyewitnesses that were there said that the police did use truncheons.
Coincidentally, Sergei Lovochkin is a close associate to many U.S. politicians. The Security Service of Ukraine had evidence that on that night, Lovochkin was in contact with opposition leader Yatsenyuk, where they discussed the clearing of Maidan on the pretext of installing the annual Christmas tree. News media reported that the riot police cruelly attacked the students peacefully sleeping in their tents
But scenes from the event seem to tell a different story. It appears that the protesters were waiting for the police. Additionally, there were dozens of journalists and cameramen from all the new public TV news outlets prepared to cover the events. And most ominously, a group of well-trained young men arrived to Maidan almost simultaneously with the riot police. They infiltrated the crowd and began provocations with insults, stones, and torches.
The riot sector in Ukraine represents a part of the Ukrainian population that has often favored fairly extreme right-wing positions. They had militias that came especially during the Maidan protests. There were groups that were being shipped into Kiev where they would provide the muscle, in effect, for the demonstrations. So the demonstrations went from being relatively peaceful political protests to being increasingly violent.
The first step in any detective work is to establish a motive. It is now said that Sergei Lovochkin is held in high esteem by his powerful U.S. friends. Outraged by what was reported in the news, the Ukrainian people came out in force on the next day to vent their anger with the police actions. As veiled and masked as the color revolutions can be, an attentive viewer can see subtle patterns and similarities revealing their true nature. To make crowds act as one obedient group, they have to be united at the unconscious level. The masterminds of color revolutions know this well and have perfected the art. Symbolism is one of the most powerful tools to achieve this end. Revolutionary political organizations with surprisingly similar names and even more similar logos have appeared time and again, almost as omens marking the countries that would be hit by the colored plague next. They are often described as being aware and active, when they're actually trained and radical. They are the ones who take the first shot, literal and metaphorical, to transform the peaceful protests into full-blown coup d'etats. Their fingerprints can be found everywhere on the map of the color revolutions. Using all the experience of past generations, simple but effective tools like catchy sing-alongs and chanting are employed. Well known for exciting the crowd and creating a group identity, they depersonalize individuals and make them easier to manipulate. Incidentally, one such organization, Hromadske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
We will be back here on this square to celebrate with you, a Ukraine that stands with Europe and stands with the United States.
Well, members of Congress were visiting Ukraine during that period, most famously Congressman John McCain. So some of the people who were challenging their government, their elected government at that point, were being told by the senior U.S. official, a person who ran for president and a top official in the U.S. Congress, that the U.S. was with them.
I'm Senator John McCain, and it's always a pleasure to be back in Ukraine.
Senator McCain was, in a sense, giving the people in the Maidan a feeling that they had the backing of the most powerful country on earth.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
In early February of 2014, as the Maidan crisis was getting more violent, there was a phone call that was intercepted. It was a call between the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk, it's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me via VFR saying, you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So okay. Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine.
You.
No, exactly.
I'm not saying the whole U.S. government feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe. The neocons are very smart people. And they've been at this for a long time. They came in around the issue of propaganda. They studied how to create hot buttons for the American people. They had this experience when they were getting the American people to get excited about Central America back in the 1980s.
Sandinista regular army. Their ground force is being equipped now with Russian artillery.
And they've been applying those same strategies ever since. They remain very dedicated to achieving their goals. They still want to get rid of certain governments. They wanted regime change in Syria, for instance, regime change in Iran. They're very skilled at this, and they have a lot of allies now inside the news media, inside the government, and that means that they can do a lot to control the narrative of any story.
I think in America these days, we have somehow told ourselves that there are a lot of ways of dealing with these problems other than hard power. Vladimir Putin cares about hard power.
The neoconservatives can now demonize a leader of a country. That sells with the American people. So you don't just sort of argue a policy. You attack the leader. So the neoconservatives became very skilled at picking out leaders, finding their ugly traits, and then highlighting them. Yanukovych, you might say, was a rather clunky political leader, but you make him into a devil. He's totally corrupt, and he's evil, and he wants to kill people in the Maidan, these wonderful white-hatted demonstrators. So you've got a black hat versus white hat. You keep repeating that basic scenario, and it works with the American people.
You've got to realize what Vladimir Putin is. He's an old KGB colonel that wants to restore the Russian Empire.
You make them into demons, and the American people find that the way they can understand the world. Once that happens, it's very difficult for a journalist or anyone else to say, you know, hold it, that guy, he's kind of more of a gray hat than a white hat or a black hat. And if you say that, you suddenly are you're a Yanukovych apologist or you're a Putin apologist, and then the attacks come on to the person saying it, the journalist, the academic, or whoever.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013 was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city.
On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine, this has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs. On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
Et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later.
For weeks, this European capital has been the scene of a violent uprising. Today, the bloodiest day yet.
The protesters are pushing up towards the government district, armed here with Molotov cocktails, but we saw handguns and shotguns too. There are casualties on both sides.
Well, she's just said that there are six dead people up there. Not just injured, dead. They say they've been hit by snipers.
And here again, we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who was at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. Each of you here should stay strong in spirit, he said, because we're not going anywhere.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking an interesting question. That question is regarding a Quranic concept or something related in the Quran. And that is that when we read about the Prophet Sulaiman in the Quran, we read that there was a party, a number of genies or jinn under his command, and they were controlled by him, and he would use them to do certain tasks, to build certain things, and so on and so forth. Right, so the question we want to ask is that whether these genies, were they capable of being seen by normal people or not? Because, right now, we can't see any of these genies or jinn, that are around us. But so we want to ask whether this was the same regarding those jinn or not. In order to respond to this question, we can first of all say this. According to some tafasir, for example, Fakhr Razi in Mafatihul Ghaib, volume 26, page 395 to 396, he mentions this there, that, of course, this tradition, this hadith, doesn't go back to the A'imma, alayhi salam. And because of that, we cannot definitely authenticate it, right? Nevertheless, this is present there. But there he writes that the genies in the era of Hazrat Sulaiman, they actually possessed a physical body, like, normal physical bodies, and normal people could see them. After the death of Hazrat Sulaiman, God Almighty, he destroyed this category, this class of genies, this class of jinn, and he created a new set, a new class, a new species, you might say, of genies, who were incapable of being seen, right? It's interesting to note that this same tradition has been mentioned by, or not this, the same event, or the same, this has been mentioned as well by Majlisi, Allama Majlisi in Mihar al-Anwar, volume 60, page 191, right? So it's present there, but we can't really authenticate this, so therefore, in essence, we don't really know the answer to this question. And, this goes back to whether we can say whether these beings are, actually physical beings that can be seen by the naked eye, or no, they're some sort of spiritual, immaterial beings, which can only be seen by a person whose spiritual eye is open or not. There's nothing that clearly indicates which one of these is true and which one of them is false. So in essence, there is no definite and definitive answer to the question as far as we know. At the same time, there are certain indications in certain hadiths that, you know, these genies, these jinn, they can manifest themselves in physical form, and in that way they can be seen, right? But whether they can be seen in their essential form or not is something which is, again, we don't have any definitive answer to. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at whether the genie of the Prophet Sulaiman could be seen or not. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. It's a massive topic. It's a massive undertaking. So tonight, I want to look at God. And I want to start off by relaying this conversation between Shaitan and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah Al-Araf. Where now, of course, you know, he, at this moment now, Shaitan now is asking Allah, Allah, I want to be, or grant me, anzurni ila yome yuba'athun. Grant me respite until the day of uprising. It's interesting to note, and scary to note, that Shaitan, in who he is and what he ended up, was a jinn that believed in God. As a khalik, khalaqtani min nar wa khalaqtuhu min teen. You created me from fire, he says.